Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of the podcast. Today, we will be talking about the war in Ukraine.
My name is Eva.
And I'm Anna. And we have a special guest today, Maciek, who will introduce himself shortly.
Hiya.
In this episode, we want to focus not on the ins and outs of the war, or neither of us are kind of military experts. We want to talk about particularly the response in Poland and especially on the Polish left, and present a kind of Central Eastern European perspective on the conflict.
Right. So maybe Maciek, if you could introduce yourself a bit.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I think this is a very important topic to talk about, and it's great to talk about it also from a Polish point of view. So my name is Maciek. I'm a Polish socialist living in UK. I've lived in UK for over half of my life now, and I am a member of a Polish political organization / party called Razem. I'm also a member of a worker co-op based in London and of the wider worker co-op movement. I also ran a small Polish Facebook page in Polish about Western imperialism and stuff like that. So I do a lot of different things. But yeah, that's about it. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Let's start with the basics. Like, what do you think the mood is now in Poland? How have like your friends and family been reacting to the news? Because, for example, as soon as the news broke out that Russia's invading Ukraine, my mum got in touch with me asking, are they coming for us next? Like, I said that there's a lot of fear. Is that your experience as well?
I think so. I don't necessarily think that it's going to happen. But that doesn't mean that people are not afraid of what's happening next. I think just the fact that this happened in the first place came as a shock to a lot of people. And there's this sort of aura of like unpredictability right now. So I think a lot of people just have no idea what's going to happen next. And they do assume that there is a possibility that, you know, maybe Poland will be next, even though I personally think that's not very likely. But we are obviously politically and strategically in the way, so to speak. So we would be naturally next in line, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a sense that Putin is acting very irrationally, like few people expected this scale of invasion to take place, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly why there's such a kind of, yeah, feeling of fear, because everyone is just, although the war was happening, right? We all knew that the situation is not good for the past 8 years at least, but it reaches back even further. Still, the scale, I think, came as a surprise even for Ukraine itself. And that's why the situation seems so bleak, because nobody knows what to expect now. But I think what we can observe from the first week is that the reaction of community, both like Polish nationals, all the neighbors of Ukraine, is also quite unprecedented in terms of mobilization of like a civic society. So maybe let's focus a bit on that. What do you guys think? Can we describe the situation in Poland and in the neighboring countries, and maybe talk a bit about the background of the war?
Yeah, I mean, Poland was very quick to kind of open the doors to Ukrainian refugees, which obviously stands in contrast with the way we've seen other refugees treated in Poland over recent months in particular. And there seems to be, well, with some exceptions, there seems to be remarkable kind of political unity on this question, right? Would you agree with that?
I think so, yeah. Obviously, like the thing you've mentioned, a lot of people talk about the sort of hypocrisy of the West, and even in Poland, in terms of like what's been happening to let's call them brown refugees at the Belarusian border, who are not allowed to be let in. And then when white immigrants coming from Ukraine are let in, then obviously people pointed that out as hypocrisy. However, nonetheless, like, of course, even despite the complicated history between our two nations, Poland is letting people in. There's been this amazing response from people, and non-stop on Facebook I see people talking about like, oh, I have a family of Ukrainians living in my house now. Or even people in Berlin, like my Polish friends in Berlin, are talking that Ukrainians have sort of moved there as well, and are seeking like refuge and a place to stay. So yeah, it's quite incredible that there's so many good-hearted people who are willing to go that extra step and sort of
yeah. Yeah, I've seen this in London as well. Like the Lewisham Police Centre has been collecting donations and been kind of overwhelmed with people and expressing support. Even at some of the Solidarity with Ukraine protests, we've seen loads of Polish flags, right? I think there's a sense that like our nations, our countries have a lot in common, right? There's a lot of shared history.
Of course, yeah. I think the shared history is, you know... we can talk probably more about the sort of history obviously what's been happening during the Soviet Union and before that, you know, and I think it's a quite sort of complicated history, and also between sort of Polish and Ukrainian relations. I think, you know, the important thing that we need to remember is, you know, when we talk about what's been happening when the Soviet Union existed, the sort of, you know, the Soviet hegemony in the region, it wasn't peaceful, it wasn't voluntaristic, it wasn't friendly. And I'm not even talking about sort of the satellite countries like Poland, but, you know, obviously all the Baltic states that were part of the Soviet Union. That relationship with the Soviet Union wasn't, you know, as friendly as some people want us to believe. And therefore, after, you know, 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think a lot of those countries, as Poland, including Poland, they thought that this is sort of a short opportunity where they can make a decision about themselves that doesn't necessarily involve Russian influence. And I think, you know, if you speak with a lot of people in Poland and they describe what's been happening between 1939 and 1989, they describe it as a situation where first we were occupied by Nazi forces and then we were occupied by Soviet forces. They don't really see there being a moment where we've been like completely independent and we could make decisions about ourselves. Now, obviously, as the sort of wider left, we can discuss whether the decision about joining NATO was a good one, whether it was beneficial at the time. But this was a decision that the Polish government has made, that Polish people have made, and decided to join NATO at the time. And this is the same sort of case with other countries in the region who just, you know, decided to make that stance and do that. And I think later we can talk about NATO in general and our approach to
we'll
it.
Definitely,
but
come back to it.
Yeah. But just sort of like as a gist of it, I think, you know, we have a shared sort of history of being in basically, you know, like, I guess, not nominally independent and not like fully independent from the Soviet hegemony. And, you know, in Poland's case as well, before that, the Russian Empire and you know, just in general, it's a long history of us being influenced and being occupied or being, you know, exploited by first the Russian Empire, then the Soviet Union and so forth. So, yeah.
Yeah, kind of subsequent Polish governments of all stripes have been quite invested in kind of supporting Ukraine to free itself from Russian influence and kind of bring it closer to the West, right? Poland played a big role in the 2004 Orange Revolution, right? When kind of pro-Russian forces tried to rig an election, but kind of mass protests stopped that. And why is there so much kind of interest in making sure that Ukraine is closer to us than it is to Russia? What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very important strategic territory for both Russia and for the West, and I think particularly when you think about Russia, I think it's a complicated thing because obviously, especially if you listen to what Putin was saying recently when he was justifying the invasion. I mean, he describes it as a military intervention because he was hoping that it would be finished within 3 days. Guess what? It's not. But I think, you know, the Russian perspective on this is that Ukraine is a sort of regional identity, right? So perhaps from our point of view, this would, you know, what we think about Kashuba or Silesia, for instance, right? That's the Russian perspective. That perhaps, you know, it's a regional identity that has its own language, own culture, but at the end of the day, is a part of the greater whole, which is Russia, right? So that's why you hear Putin saying, for instance, things like Ukraine. It was a mistake that Ukraine came to be in the first place, that Ukraine should be just part of Russia and so forth. So obviously that's a Russian perspective. The Ukrainian perspective, and especially, you know, it's quite obvious, right? You know, especially, you know, since the Second War and the sort of nationalist movements in Ukraine, the sort of general perception is that, no, we are an independent country. We want to be an independent country. We don't want to be just part of the greater whole, you know? That's one aspect of it. Obviously, the second aspect is that Ukraine is very important from a strategic and economical point of view for Russia as well, right? Because, for instance, you know, it's the main sort of corridor when it comes to gas pipelines. The eastern Ukraine, big parts of eastern Ukraine, the infrastructure there has been developed over years to support Russian production chains. So it's quite integrated into the Russian economy, not like mostly politically, but also in its sort of, you know, on a sort of trade kind of level. So obviously Russia wants to have a massive influence there because it's a very important strategic thing for Russia. When it comes to the West and the NATO, obviously it's just about, you know, being as close to Russia as possible in terms of, you know, militaristic sort of advances and things like that. But that's also then again the American and NATO point of view, right? But then you have to think about the sort of what's in between, you know, the Polish point of view, which is basically like, again, a country that basically wants to decide about itself and not necessarily be torn between two imperial powers.
And I think what is also important to remember, and maybe not everyone realizes, like, this is a country of 44 million people. Ukraine is very complex as a nation. And obviously, there's a lot of propaganda coming from Russia that also reaches the left. And this is like the problem, right? We hear that, I don't know, a lot of people don't have the knowledge about the history of Ukraine, and they might sometimes just fall into these traps. And we also know that Putin is funding a lot of far-right organizations, both in Poland, but also here in UK, and in general is trying to influence the narrative so strongly that, again, it's just obviously a very difficult field to you know, grasp within an hour or so. We will not be able to unpack all of it here. But there's so much disinformation that we just need to bear that in mind and remember that at the end of the day, we're talking about a huge nation that often is, again, discarded in a way. They're not given the voice that they deserve to speak about their own situation.
Yeah. And I think one thing you mentioned, right, which I think is important for us to highlight about like the Polish point of view on this, because, you know, in Poland, it is the far right and the sort of right libertarian section of politics that is pro-Putin.
So like Konfederacja.
The Konfederacja, for instance, like, you know, like the sort of infamous Janusz Korwin-Mikke, who is this enormous of minarchist libertarian idiot.
Yeah, famous for saying that women should not have the right to vote because they're stupid.
Exactly, amongst many other things that he says. I mean, the social aspect, like politically and economically, he's insane. and his ideas are quite... But he's like a person who'd say that, for instance, Poland needs to leave NATO and associate itself with Russia, right? Yeah. And this is the far right and the right libertarian side of Polish politics. So obviously... nobody on the Polish left would like to identify with those points of view as well, because they find them just absolutely ridiculous and ludicrous. So,
and yeah, and it's an open secret that some of the kind of prominent anti-abortion, anti-LGBT campaigners in Poland are also funded by Kremlin.
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, we sort of chatted briefly about this before we started recording, which is about like how pro-Putin forces influence whatever they find comfortable and useful in every single country, right? So in case of Poland, they will support the sort of far-right, right libertarian voices. In other places, it might be actually the left voices that are more sort of beneficial to them to support. So they will sort of broadcast their propaganda aimed at those people there. And it changes across many different countries. But at the end of the day, it's whatever makes their position stronger and the West position weaker. And there's no left agenda. There's no socialist agenda there. It's just like whatever they find useful, they will support and they will fund. And that's about it.
Yeah, of course. Like Russia Today here, like, tries to associate itself with the left.
Yeah, and I think the context of campism is very much on Putin's side to kind of argue and actually hit the lefty circles. So it's quite, as you say, bizarre that in Poland the views that are extremely dangerous are repeated by the far right, whereas here we hear the echoes of it in the left.
Yeah.
And obviously we can't generalize the whole left. It's a very difficult thing to, again, speak about everyone. But I guess we can point to the sides of the British left, for example, that we know of, that keep on kind of saying things that are extremely dangerous and have just an impact on the whole way the left starts to think about these issues. And I guess that's why we also gathered here to kind of try and oppose these very dangerous influences, speak about them openly, and also give our own perspective from the country that is so involved in all these issues for years.
Yeah, and I think one thing you mentioned, which is about like the size of the country, right? Because some people think like, oh, Ukraine is just a small European country, insignificant country, and it's like it's an enormous country, and obviously it has an enormous population that you know represents a really broad spectrum of politics, right? And there's this extremely naive argument being spread around about like the denazification of Ukraine, right? Obviously, the fact that the Azov battalion exists and is sort of officialized by the Ukrainian government is a disgrace. That's a fact. But by the same token, like the perception that's trying to be sort of created is that the whole country glorifies Nazis, right? Yep. I think their connection with Bandera is controversial, even in Ukraine itself, you know, in terms of like how they portray him, see him. Most of the Ukrainians don't see him as obviously someone that advances sort of fascist values. It's more a person, a hero who made Ukraine happen, right? So it's a complicated thing that's even controversial in Ukraine. And obviously it upsets me when I see his portraits around, you know, Ukraine, when I see the sort of red and black flags being waved and stuff like that because of, you know, the massacres carried out by Ukrainian nationalists. But the same token, I don't believe for a minute that the whole country is pro-Nazi, pro-fascist, and I just think that's frankly insane. And we know that the far right has tried to exploit Euromaidan, for instance, the protests and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we had like two elections since then, and Svoboda has lost seats. You know, like it's more of the sort of centre-left, centre-right sort of parties that are now sort of dominating politics there. It's not like Nazis. It's not like far right.
Yeah. You know? Well, we have a massive far right problem in Poland, but I don't want Russia to invade us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I don't want to be saved.
Yeah.
And again, that's exactly what Putin wants. Putin wants to portray Ukraine as a kind of proxy country, which has a like a very weak government, which is also dangerous. And we should just say that openly, that there's no way that Ukraine can be can fit the description that Putin is trying to impose. And also, I think this this is what he was hoping for, that his kind of propaganda in Russia was all based on the fact that, well, we are actually helping Ukraine through this intervention, as he calls it, and we are trying to save it from itself, right?
Yeah, so I think the saving from itself is obviously sort of centered around like the civil war happening in the eastern part of the country, right? Where there's loads of propaganda as well. I mean, obviously from on both sides, and that's where you see like some of the far right nationalist Ukrainian forces fighting as well. But you have you know, stories about like shellings happening every single day and people dying, and all of the people, they're desperately crying out to be saved by Russia, which is obviously not true because it is a civil war happening there, and there is a sort of there's many different forces there, many different sort of groups of people who are either pro-Ukraine or pro-Russian or even sort of neutral. Then, you know, they just don't want the war. They just want the sort of conflict to stop happening, you know. And I think they're trying to create this perception that the whole region is crying out for Russia to heroically step in and save them from Ukraine. Mm.
And we hear even on social media, Russian people saying that because they are just hearing that constantly for years. And I guess what is good to kind of reference here is the amount of people who were displaced within Ukraine since 2014. The treatment of Crimean Tatars, the amount of people fleeing to Poland even before the escalation of this conflict. But again, Putin is trying to turn that around. And I guess what we can also say so far, seeing how the conflict unfolded, I mean, the way Ukrainian nation is trying to defend itself, and they are doing it very successfully so far. I guess nobody, Putin for sure, haven't expected this amount of just heroism And that also works to his disadvantage, because suddenly the whole myth and propaganda that he's trying to build collapses. Yep. There's no way for him to maintain that narrative, because suddenly they don't want to give up. They don't want to bring with open arms, kind of say, oh, finally, our saviors are here.
But this is what the TV was showing.
Yeah.
Because my friend, he has Ukrainian family, Polish friend, who has a Ukrainian family, who's been watching Russian TV, mm-hmm. Russian national TV, and that was the sort of initial stories that were being broadcast, which is basically interviews with Ukrainians who are saying like, oh, glory to Russia, thank you so much for coming mm-hmm. here and mm-hmm. for rescuing us. And that was the sort of language, a sort of story that they wanted to sort of build up, and then obviously now it's difficult for them to sort of keep it up when you see such a massive resistance in the country, right?
Yes.
You
know? Yeah. So obviously this has caused some conflict between the Polish left and sections of the international left. We saw Razem, the Polish left party, quitting working with Progressive International and DiEM25 over their kind of equivocation, trying to kind of both sides this issue, right?
Yeah.
I think it's important not to kind of caricature the left as being like pro-Putin. I think some people on the right have, definitely cynically tried to accuse like Corbyn Momentum of being like much more pro-Putin than the people are. Like,
of course,
it's like people who are defending the invasion is marginal. But I think what happens much more is kind of claiming that this is in some way an understandable reaction to NATO expansion.
Exactly.
Or
yeah.
that, this is a war between like two empires, right? Russia and the US, Russia and NATO, which, yeah, as you said, kind of ignores the fact that there's countries in the middle which
want
to sovereignly like decide their own foreign policy, right?
Yeah, I think there's like, for instance, if you look at the British Communist Party, like they've released a joint sort of statement with other organizations, and they sort of described the points of view on different things. And one of them was that, I guess what they emphasized was that this would have been avoided if not for NATO, which is basically that this is all NATO's fault, like that the intervention is unjustified and it shouldn't have happened, but it's all NATO's fault, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think just oversimplifies the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. And it's very convenient for Putin, because that's exactly what he wants the kind of international audience to believe, that he's legitimate in trying to attack. And
yeah.
that is just absolutely not true. And also, as much as we can be against NATO, we cannot connect its expansion with his sick ambitions. It's completely not the reason why he's doing it. And it's enough to also look at how he speaks about this invasion, how he justifies historically, and what we've mentioned before. It's really also hard to, explain such irrational actions with irrational arguments, because there's just no rational argument for what he's doing.
No, absolutely.
Sorry, Anna,
you go.
No, sorry, it's actually a question of NATO, because like that is a quite difficult and uncomfortable one for a lot of the kind of Eastern European, including Polish left, right? Because I think a lot of the left rightly criticize NATO both in theory and in practice as a force kind of supporting American imperialism. We should oppose and we should feel at least uncomfortable about. At the same time, there is a reason why Razem currently doesn't advocate for like abolishing or quitting NATO, because there is this like really real like immediate fear of a Russian invasion, which, as we can see, is not unjustified.
Yeah, I don't think there's also a practical alternative just right now, and I think this is an important thing, isn't it? That we can all be like myself, I'm anti-NATO. I think that. If we look at the interventions in Afghanistan and the region, mm-hmm. and it looks to me like it's an American intervention that then used a couple countries to then label the whole intervention as an international like a peacekeeping intervention, right? And obviously it feels to a lot of people that NATO is turning into this sort of, it's basically American imperialism, but then labeled as an international sort of movement seeking peace and justice in the world, just because of other sort of countries trying to sort of be included. Like, for instance, Poland was included, like in Afghanistan. You know, obviously there are some positives from being NATO members, like our sort of military spending has been reduced, with the so-called sort of peace dividend that we get. And that's obviously a good thing. But at the same token is like, obviously we oppose many of the sort of actions that are taken by NATO. But like we said, right now, pragmatically, there simply doesn't seem to be an alternative. Like it's not easy for us to say like let's leave NATO and that's it, and we'll just fend for ourselves and it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Like it's impossible to sort of justify that, I think.
I'm just trying to play the devil's advocate and think of, you know, the arguments that someone might say, oh, maybe you are putting too much hope in the military alliance that at the end of the day is only serving the imperialistic system in general. And do we want to argue for that as left? And then there's so many contradicting feelings, I guess, because I remember even, you know, maybe it's irrelevant, but how on the history lessons, the date of Poland entering NATO have been told, what kind of narrative was there? And it's been the one of, oh, we're finally not isolated on the international scene and just left alone to Russia's attacks, right?
Yeah.
And there's just that I think it's treated as like security alliance that can somehow prevent also just even theoretically Putin from attacking because he fears NATO. And I think that's what it boils down to. What is it that Putin is actually scared of? And when we try to think of this, I guess we come up with, okay, he's scared of NATO, he's scared of European Union, he's scared of organized left, and he's scared of probably workers who would be able to unite against him. But again, he's very good at preventing that for even developing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, like, again, it's difficult to put in words because there's so many contradictions, like you said, when you sort of think about it, is that it's difficult to think of an alternative right now that we could easily quickly develop that would be beneficial for everyone involved and wouldn't be necessarily then affected by anything else. Like there's so many externalities right now that unfortunately sometimes you have to go with the lesser evil, you know.
I sort of think that it's something we should be thinking about long term because I don't want to just like the left to just accept that there is kind of no alternative to NATO and kind of park it at this.
Yeah.
No, of course. I think
that's exactly what this conflict shows, that we are actually not prepared to deal with all these issues. And we need to start creating structures in place that will be able to create that alternative system that we so want. Because we can kind of disregard it until something like this happens. And I think we all realize that the peace that we have is so illusionary. Obviously, it wasn't there. It wasn't there for the past 8 years. It hits us strongly now, but Putin have been preparing for this for years and we just let him do it, really.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the problem with the position that we're in right now, because it's so easy to just try to, you know, look for solutions in theory. But when we actually look at what we've done to prevent this from happening, there's not much we can point to.
Yeah, I think also, you know, if we want to talk sort of briefly about what's been happening with sort of NATO expansionism since the collapse of the Soviet Union, obviously there are these sort of rumours. I think there's some sort of Russian sources confirming it and some American sources confirming it, but I don't think it's like sort of official, which was, I think, in 1990, Brezhnev had assurances given from NATO that there would be no expansion.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously quickly sort of voided. I think it was 1999 that Poland and other countries joined NATO. Then, following that, and at that point, there was another second sort of unspoken agreement that okay, well, Poland joined, Hungary joined, we're going to stop there. But then the Baltic countries joined as well, and you can obviously say from the sort of, you know, again, sort of Western lefty point of view, like, okay, well, so this was the reason why Putin got angry, like Russia got angry, and therefore, you know, it's justified that many years later there would be a Ukrainian sort of intervention because obviously there were talks about Ukraine joining NATO as well. But at the same token, like, again, when we talk about it in this way and then sort of ignore everything else, it does feel like we're sort of talking about the whole territory like a massive tug of war between American imperialism, Russian imperialism, right? And we ignore everything else that's been happening. And for instance, why those countries would decide actively want to join NATO in that situation.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a lot of my issue, the way the conflict is being talked about, right? Kind of, you know, not acknowledging the agency and the sovereignty of the Ukrainian people. I mean, Owen Jones has recently rightly apologized for using the language of buffer zones, right?
Yeah,
which,
people
have like used terms like Russian spheres of influence, that like we have to accept like some countries have Russian spheres of influence. Like, we wouldn't talk that way about any other empire, would we? Well, I hope you wouldn't.
No, of course, yeah. And also, does any country really identify as being under the Russian sphere of influence, or like want to be under the Russian sphere of influence?
Yeah,
especially
against their will.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think when we think about it, it's things have changed since 1991, right? Since the Soviet Union has collapsed, you know, like the transition to capitalism in the Russian Federation, you know, initially has been quite catastrophic. Like loads of people suffered through that time, and it hasn't, you know, then country has been sort of slowly picking up and redeveloping. But what's happened in the Russian Federation, obviously now it's completely changed economically. You know, there's no left agenda there left, to be honest, you know, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, there might be some sort of left nostalgia when it comes to like the Soviet Union and sort of Soviet sort of hegemony in general. But I think sometimes when people talk about the Russian state of influence and sort of talk about, they still sort of feel like it feels like they're referring to the old hegemony, not the modern hegemony, which is completely different in my opinion. Like, it's a completely different, like the Russian empire, the entity today, it's more about like, it reminds me more of the Russian Empire than it does the Soviet Union. So,
yeah.
So it feels weird for some people to even like be like, have you considered like Russian protection, or like, you know, a Russian being in a Russian sphere of influence to be protected by by Russia. Like, it feels strange to me when we talk about it in that regard, because like even in the past, like, people weren't fully like behind the Soviet Union, you know, like on the Western left, you know, like obviously there were people who were supporting the Soviet Union and in some aspects rightfully so, in others perhaps less, but especially since the intervention in Hungary and the intervention of Czechoslovakia, like a lot more and more people became disillusioned with the Soviet Union. And I think nowadays there's nothing left to be supporting or to be like trying to protect in terms of like when it comes to the left agenda. Like, I don't see any left agenda. Just one thing also about this is I think one sort of, I guess, not justification or explanation of, so into the Western left, especially in America, sort of trying to be sort of like devil's advocate, or like, you know, like a whataboutism. I think because of the sort of, you know, McCarthyism happening in the United States, and a big portion of the American population still thinking that actually Russia is communist.
Yeah,
they tried to defend Russia because they opposed McCarthyism and sort of anti-Russian sentiment that existed in the past, and they still feel the need to do that, perhaps. And that might be one explanation in my head that why sometimes they are like, well, actually, no, like, or maybe it's justified Russia is doing it, stuff like that. Or like, maybe it's just a sort of like automatic response that they have, like an immunity response, really, even, like that they sort of like, they feel like, you know, they have to defend modern Russia because there's some aspects of the Soviet Russia that they like to defend as well. I don't know. I'm just sort of like trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
But like, sometimes it feels a bit that way as well, doesn't it?
There's also the argument, which I have a bit of sympathy for, on the UK left, that, you know, the main enemy is at home, that what we can have influence over is our own government. And therefore, it's much more effective kind of protesting in the UK against British government and government it's allies with. And as a kind of tactic, I understand that. But guess where I have problems? When it becomes a way of understanding the world. If the main enemy is at home means that, you know, anything that's anti-Western is, or, you know, anti-British, anti-whatever, anti-NATO is good. Yeah, I think we have to distinguish between the tactic of prioritizing protests here with the sort of political understanding. Because that's actually, you know, is that weirdly kind of a Western-centric way of seeing the world?
Exactly,
if we think
that
like the West is the only agent, like there's also other imperialisms, like Russia is also capable of imperialism, and so are other countries.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it also annoys me when, you know, when you sort of raise that fact that, you know, some on the far left, I'm mostly talking about like Marxists, some Marxist-Leninists, not all of them, like when you talk about Russian imperialism, they come back saying like, oh, actually Russia is an imperialist, like read Lenin, you know, because it will explain things to you. And I find it so silly, because even if you do read Lenin, I don't think there's anything that
justifies that. And then look at Stalin.
It's just, I just don't think it makes any sense, you know. Yeah. And I think it clearly is an imperial force, you know, that is trying to enforce its sort of influence over the world. You know, it's been doing it in Africa, it's been doing it in Asia, it's obviously, there's friction between Russia and China as well, and you know.
So I think what sums up this is neither Russia nor US, right? We don't have to go for one of them, and side with them against the other, we shouldn't be choosing any, because they both represent the very similar imperialistic system of trying to create
the Ukrainian people in this situation. I think that's what it is, because I think a lot of people say like you have to take sides between Putin and between NATO, and I think like that's not true. And I think this is the sort of centrism that I think is acceptable, not the centrism of like I support neither Ukraine or Russia in this conflict. It's more like I support neither NATO or Putin in this conflict, but I support the Ukrainian people. I want Russia to get the F out of there so that they can live in peace, you know, and they can decide for themselves what they want to do next. That's what I'm trying to say.
At the same time, I think like what you say is very interesting, but like the legacy of the Cold War and leaves like no shortage of anti-Russian sentiment society, and I'm slightly worried that, you know, there's been rightly a lot of solidarity with Ukraine, but some of it can also, you know, come back to these like old like anti-Russian tropes. Like we saw Chris Bryan, for example, calling on the dual UK Russian nationals to pick one citizenship, when it's like many of them are probably people who moved here because they don't like Putin, well, it was happening in Russia, right? So I think we need to like strongly push back against that kind of thing.
Well, there are so many people in Russia that are opposing this war, but they just don't know how to oppose it.
All the like anti-war protests we're seeing in Russia are illegal. Like people are risking many years in prison.
Yeah,
so it's
course.
Really quite heroic when we're seeing. Should we talk a little bit about kind of solutions about, you know, what demands we can be putting forward, what can we kind of be practically doing to help? I mean, you know, in terms of we talked about how, you know, kind of knee-jerk anti-Russian sentiment is also not helpful. But, like, should we be calling for sanctions? Like, what are the things we should be campaigning around?
I think this is an interesting question. And I think it's a more difficult one to answer, because I think whatever you suggest might have its pros and cons and might face fierce criticism or fierce support, depending on what you say. Mm-hmm. In terms of sanctions, I think some of the sanctions that are being proposed or have been sort of happened are quite ridiculous, frankly. You know, like I think whatever inconveniences Russian people is in the sense of, instance, like, okay, they can't access Netflix or something like that, that's fine. But like, obviously, the current sanctions have crippled the Russian economy, right? You know, when you look at the representative of a central bank talking about how they have to increase the sort of percentage rates, interest rates to 20%. You know, you can clearly see that there's loads of inflation in the country, and there has been a massive effect. But I think some of the suggestions of like we sort of discussed before, which is like ban Russian films in Europe, you know, or like remove Russian products. Like some of it just feels a bit like, or like you see shops, for instance, just like using it as a marketing opportunity and being like, hey, we don't serve Russian food anymore.
Yeah, it's literally like a PR message.
It feels like a PR sort of strategy, right?
And I would defend changing the spelling of Chicken Kiev. I think that's a good move.
I mean, yeah. I guess again, as left, we should be thinking. Obviously, it's so complex, because sanctions themselves, what are sanctions, right? When we think about them, they might be the imperial might again to resolve a situation, just not militarily but economically, right? So this financial system itself, the banking system, the way to punish a nation, it's kind of just problematic in itself, but then we don't want to end up not doing anything, right?
Yeah, obviously we want to, like, you know, apply as much pressure as possible for Russia to just leave the country. But at the same token, we don't want to ruin people's lives.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to come up with something that is very targeted and has the least sort of impact on regular Russians and the biggest impact on the oligarchs and all the other people in charge in Russia. And I think that's the difficult question here. Like, what actually is going to work, and what will, and whether there is an acceptable amount of like collateral damage that we can accept, or is there none? You know, like I think it's a very difficult question to what's acceptable here.
And I think we end up basically, you know, there are certain principles on the left that we try to realize what should we do? Should we go against some of the things that we believe in order to, as we said earlier, choose a lesser evil and kind of not stay completely inactive with all of this? But what I guess we should be really realizing now is that we don't actually have anything prepared from like the very, you know, workers kind of perspective and very international kind of cooperation of the left perspective to oppose this. And we start to rely and fall back on the means that are there that are really against our own, what we argue on a daily basis. So we start to refer to the imperialists for help and we start to rely on that. And I, as much as I understand it, I'm trying to think of things that we can do here and now to start to build something entirely different.
Yeah, but I sort of I think what you mentioned is quite interesting in terms of like trying to build something to be prepared maybe for like next time, or like to start talking about like, okay, so what are the alternatives? And maybe there is, this means that there's, it's high time now for us to start thinking like, okay, so we talk about being anti-NATO, we talk about like NATO being bad, but like, is there a genuine project or solution that we can think of, whether it's like, you know, NATO disbanding and then having like country-to-country relations when it comes to defence? Do we have like a European bloc that's supported by the European Union? It's, I think, important to sort of start talking about like, okay, what is the sort of pragmatic solution, sensible solution that would be acceptable and that would actually be an improvement upon what we have here right now, you know?
Yeah. And I think in terms of sort of immediate demands that the left should be able to unite around, I mean, firstly, like accepting refugees. We already mentioned that Poland maybe uncharacteristically opened its borders. The EU has also kind of moved to allow Ukrainians to live in the EU for 3 years, whereas the UK government is a
appalling reaction.
Yeah, it's completely appalling. And actually, the Labour Party has also shown like zero moral courage. So like accepting refugees and opening the borders. But using that to also talk about, you know, the rights of other refugees who maybe look a bit less like us is, yeah, I think something we should be able to unite around. I think I quite like the demand to drop Ukraine's debt.
Mm.
I think, you know, obviously a war will have horrible kind of economic consequences and lasting ones, right? So dropping the debt is a kind of practical act of solidarity.
Mm. And what are we thinking in terms of, I know it's a very difficult one, but, you know, there are some slogans such as for NATO to do the no-fly zone, right? What are your guys' thoughts? Because I found myself very contradicted on that. That's very militaristic kind of resolution again.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to put that out there. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good question. I think sometimes when you see people talk about this, it feels a bit like, oh, it's just a no-brainer, like a no-fly zone. Whereas, like, they, like you forget that, okay, well, if you have a no-fly zone, someone has to enforce it, right? So it's not like you just say, oh, you can't fly here anymore. Sorry, no planes. No, sorry, you can't fly.
Is it escalation or de-escalation? What are we aiming here for, right?
That's the whole thing. So obviously, if a no-fly zone is imposed, then this is a literal confrontation between powers. It's then, for instance, like who would be doing the enforcement? It will probably have to be NATO. And if it's NATO enforcing it, then it sort of slowly enters in an open conflict with Russia.
That will be really scary.
That would be pretty scary. Obviously, this is what the Ukrainian government is calling for, and it's not just an idea that's been floating around by other parties. This is what they actually are demanding. So obviously, I think we should respect that and at least listen to what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
At the same token, personally, I just struggle to think how this could lead to a good outcome, because I just think, especially looking at how at the unpredictable nature of what Putin's been doing recently, you have no idea what's that gonna end up with.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Putin, I think yesterday he openly said that, you know, if there's a no-fly zone imposed, that's an open act of war with Russia.
Mm-hmm. And there we're looking at the scenario of probable World War III.
Exactly. I mean, obviously a lot of people say it's an exaggeration, like we have to, like, there's nothing that will surprise me anymore. I think I wouldn't be even surprised, if Russia does, like, I don't know, like a limited nuclear strike somewhere just to show off its power. Like, I'm honestly not going to be surprised by anything anymore.
Putin really proved that he's completely unpredictable, and we cannot rely on his senses or the advisors around him to be responsible in this position, right? And
I think, you know, there's been this sort of recent thing floating around the internet, an apparent leak from I can't remember the exact agency in Russia, the Secret Service or something, not Secret Service, sorry, but I can't remember the exact organization, but there was a leak document sort of responding to the conflict and stuff like that. And they're talking about, obviously, no idea if this is true or not, but it's an interesting sort of talking point, I think, because it was saying how they were initially asked if there are sanctions against Russia, and if there's a possible conflict, then would Russia survive? And then obviously they said, like, yeah, it's going to be fine, don't worry, we'll take care of everything. The reason I'm saying this is that there is a potential that, you know, that what Putin is doing is not necessarily completely rational. It's just that he had assurances from specific groups in Russia that it's going to be fine if something happens. And I think none of these groups actually assumed that it's actually going to happen, that massive escalation will actually happen, and that you know, they will have to actually deal with it in real life. It's not just a theoretical sort of thought experiment that they have to go through and then sort of think like, oh, well, if the sanctions, are we going to survive economically and things like that. And I think also, you know, again, Putin had assumptions made in the beginning quite clearly that he thought it's going to be like a two or three day thing. They're going to take Kiev. And then they're either going to make Zelensky sort of, you know, capitulate and you know, we don't know what the outcome would fully be. But I think they weren't thinking this is going to go for so long. And I think now he's just pretending that this is all going according to plan.
Yeah. To maintain the message that he had there before.
So I don't think it might. I don't think it's like necessarily like we can't just assume that it's completely 100% irrational. I think that it might be a bit more complicated than that. But it's definitely unpredictable.
Well, I would say that it's still definitely planned. It's still planned. Definitely, the action wasn't just, oh, he woke up one day and said like, I'm sending troops. It's been prepared for years, and we have to know that. You know, even when you look at the far right, and we often just, you know, look with horror of what they're saying and arguing. Oftentimes, they're very good at convincing people to support them, and you know, they have an actual strategy in place. And sometimes, I'm as hard as it is for me to say, the international kind of cooperation of far right is sometimes much better than the one of the left.
Exactly.
And we can't just, you know, ignore or discard the danger that is there, while also say that the kind of motives are completely irrational and they're not justifiable in any way.
I think also I mean, this is just like one talking point that people sometimes have, which is that Russia sort of witnessing how badly America, but also European Union, responded to the COVID crisis compared to, say, Asia, where the response was a lot better. And they saw how disorganized loads of countries were in response to the pandemic. Perhaps Putin has made an assumption that any possible response to an intervention could possibly be equally disorganized as well. And that's why he was a lot more confident in terms of what he's doing. Obviously, there hasn't been any sort of response yet on a large scale from other countries. But I think maybe that's what sort of added a bit of like fuel to his tank, you know. I don't know.
Coming back to, you know, the issue of the military kind of intervention, I guess my take, it's probably, you know, not perfect, but just trying to support the people in Ukraine that are on the ground, in terms of just, you know, instead of having the force outside involved, trying to send some kind of help within. I guess that's something we can argue as left. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I
agree. I think there's, oh, sorry, Anna, I'll let you.
No worries. I just say it's like, I know we're kind of slowly running out of time, so it's kind of good to end on a kind of positive and productive note, right? You know, we've talked about World War III and the nuclear explosions. And I know a lot of people, myself included, are feeling very anxious. Like, what can we do? How can we help?
Great question. I mean, I obviously, like you said, help the refugees, give them shelter. Obviously, here in UK, it's little we can do. But there are people who are trying to sort of rejoin their relatives in UK. And we should obviously, if there's any opposition to that from the government, we should obviously oppose this as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Make sure it's as smooth as possible for them to seek shelter here if they need to. And I think that's definitely something we should do. Obviously support any of the organisations that are trying to help people on the ground there in any meaningful way. That's definitely an important thing to do. And a non-controversial thing to do as well, I think. You know?
In Poland, we've seen a kind of outpouring of solidarity with people like welcoming Ukrainians to their homes, right?
Yeah,
there's been loads of that going on.
Really beautiful to see. I think there was this sort of initial sort of information about how only white Ukrainians were being elected into the country. I think now that's not a problem anymore. And I think that hopefully this is something that we can promote in the future. And we can hopefully use this situation as well to highlight other conflicts around the world as well. Like say like, okay, so you've paid attention to this horrible conflict in Ukraine. Next time, let's make sure that we have the same outpouring of solidarity during other conflicts as well and other interventions that are even happening right now as we speak. So,
yeah, exactly. Like that difference is very disturbing.
That's true. Yeah,
it's really disturbing.
Hope that we could then remind people that what they've done today in the future when help is needed on other fronts as well to sort of copy this sort of expression of solidarity and repeat it and keep doing it, you know, for everyone, regardless whether it's Ukrainian people or Middle Eastern refugees or people who will be soon having to escape the calamity caused by global warming and have to like migrate to other countries as well.
We're already seeing that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. In terms of in the UK, you know, we can definitely campaign for our government to be less terrible on this issue. And although, you know, well, it's the Tories, what can we say? I also recommend following Ukraine Solidarity Campaign. It's a left-led, kind of, you know, migrant-centered solidarity movement.
Yes, I think we should mention some organizations that are already there and try to empower them. Also, journalists who are on the ground. We mentioned that there's a huge problem with propaganda, both in Russia, in Belarus, which we didn't really touch upon so much, but it's another very strategically important place to organize in and try to create some kind of opposition within. And then just trying to maybe actually, yes, get go out of our ways to create something completely new, some kind of organization that can incorporate people, workers, the kind of huge potential of opposition that is so hard to now, you know, organize because we just didn't have the structures. But it has to stay that way. We can really change something, and I guess it's very important to remember that. And the last thing, I'm sorry, but I guess it's very important again when we hear the left, our comrades, saying things such as, well, NATO is to blame for this partially as well. We should be trying to push against that, try to explain how this really serves Putin's goals. And again, remember that while we can be very critical of a military alliance such as NATO, we need to remember how this nuance here is so important, and this is something that just needs to be remembered on the left, and we need to look at ourselves very critically as well, listen to people who have a very direct experience of living under the influence of Russia, and some people here in UK might never really thought of that the same way because they just aren't in that position, and historically they didn't deal with so much of trauma connected with the imperialism that Russia serves.
Yeah, same token, like, yeah, you have to understand there is this nuance there, and it's not just it's just a choice between two powers, and that's about it. There's more to it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, thank you very much for this conversation. I think it was very interesting.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Follow the podcast. We have different social media channels. We will be trying to release the episodes quite regularly every week. And
we have one coming up on the situation on the border with Belarus, which we've kind of touched upon today. So if you're interested in broader refugee issues in Poland, please listen to that. We have many more interesting episodes planned. So please follow us. And if you have any ideas or comments or disagree with us and want to discuss it, please get in touch.
Yes. And also remember that it's just the beginning for the conversation. We are just not able to cover all the issues here, but we just wanted to bring something that will maybe be thought-provoking, maybe for some people just a starting point to research it more and get interested. Yes. Hopefully
Thank
we
you.
Achieved that. Thank you.